Hello and welcome, everyone. I am Jake Wurzak, and this is Masters of Moments. This podcast features conversations with the top entrepreneurs and business leaders around hospitality, real estate, investing, and company building. Thank you so much for joining me and enjoy the show. You've heard it on the podcast so many times, and I'm going to say it again. Relationships are everything in real estate. At Dove Hill Capital Management, one of the most interesting things about our track record is that the majority of the deals have come to us off market or lightly marketed. So we had this innovative idea a few years ago, and that was to launch the Deal Rewards Program at Dove Hill Capital Management. If you want to learn more, you can go to www.dovehillcos.com. Again, that's www.dovehillcos.com. You click on the little deal rewards icon and you can sign up. And if you have a deal that's off market that somehow came to you, maybe you're working on a deal, you're trying to put it together, bring it to us because we can help you get that deal done through our deal rewards program. We offer industry-leading incentives. We'll allow you to co-invest in the deal. We could come up with another interesting structure to allow you to do the deal with us. The Deal Rewards Program is incredibly unique and will give you an opportunity to do a deal with Dove Hill, either in a completely passive position or maybe you're taking a more active role. Either way, please check out the Deal Rewards Program at www.dovehillcos.com. Appreciate it. And this is how we've been getting our flow. The team at Wurzak Hotel Group is just firing on all cylinders right now. So I am very, very excited and proud to announce that we now have a third-party management program where we are managing hotels for other owners. We used to just manage hotels for ourselves, and now we've made some tremendous forward investments in people, our team, technology, accounting, finance, and most importantly, culture. And we are prepared to bring that out to everyone. Our team is experienced in managing independent hotels, branded hotels. We have focused heavily on boutique, lifestyle, and experiential hotels. And we're ready to manage a hotel for you. So if you are interested, if you want to learn more about what we do and how we can help your hotel, please visit wurzakhotels.com. I thought a really cool place to start would be actually, my first deal in real estate was flipping a house. A lot of people's first deal is flipping a house. So I thought a neat place to start would be to talk about how you transitioned from flipping houses, one-off deals, to getting into multifamily.
Yeah. I mean, my first deal was flipping a house too. I still remember the address, 2161 Glenwood Drive. And that was back when you could flip you could borrow 100%. It was crazy. It was like the 2004, 2005 era. And, you know, it was just wild. And I remember I looked up and I had like 12 something single family homes. And I think at the time, my goal was to build a portfolio of single family homes. But, you know, I transitioned really into building spec homes, you know, and then the biggest, you know, deal I did, I think prior to 2008, was a student housing deal. You know, I was introduced to an older gentleman named Ken Wilcox in Boone, North Carolina. And Ken was like the big real estate guy in this small little college town. And he owned one building in downtown Boone that was basically a glorified flea market. And, you know, I saw it and I was like, wow, so close to the university, I can convert this to student housing. And that's what I did. You know, he basically put the deal into the venture, and I went to the bank and borrowed the construction loan, and it was a successful deal. And after I built it, he bought me out. You know, he wanted to be a long-term owner. And I think the way he put it, how much to get you off the mountain. and so that was March 2008. And shortly after that, you know, the great financial crisis happened. Lehman Brothers failed, and you know, it was a disaster. But it was good for me to be. I was a young guy. I think I was 27 or 28, but I was in a good financial position and was able to capitalize coming out of it.
What did you learn about construction leading up to the great financial crisis?
Not a lot. I mean, I still can't believe, you know, I was able to build all these homes and things like that. It was at a time when you didn't have to have a general contractor's license in Georgia. And so literally I would have subcontractors that I would pick up from Home Depot come and do a lot of the work and things like that. I guess, you know, I'll take back what I said. I learned a decent amount of construction, just, you know, the basics, the nuts and bolts, what it took to get something built, you know, period. But, you know, as far as technicalities and things like that, I didn't learn a ton.
So you're doing spec houses, you're self-made. How are you doing this all with no cash? You're getting 100% financing, but didn't you need a little cash? Like, how did it all start to come together in the beginning?
You know, like I said, I was borrowing 100% of basically everything. I mean, the first home I bought, I got 100% of, and then almost immediately I would hit it with a home equity loan. And so you're basically buying these houses and 15, 20 days later, you're cashing out with a home equity loan. And, you know, so that was my cash. And, you know, I would buy these homes and either sell them or refinance them. And that was my cash going forward. You know, when I did the student housing deal, that provided me with a good amount of cash. So, you know, after the downturn, I bought 3 property management companies. And that allowed me, you know, I had the cash to basically buy those from my prior deals, from the student housing deals that I had done.
What were those management companies managing?
The first one was managing Section 8 properties, believe it or not, and affordable housing. It was called Affordable Housing Realty Management. And that was in Atlanta. There, 2 of them were in Atlanta. So that was managing like basically affordable housing. It had about 5,000 units under management. And I liked it because it had sticky, you know, contracts. The next one was referred to me by that management company. It was called Hediger Property Management. They were managing, I want to say, like 8,000 units. And again, it was a mix of kind of B type properties and affordable housing properties. And the third one was a company that went bankrupt, Miles Property. And that, I believe, was like 7,000 units. And I did a deal with the bank at the time. The bank was Wachovia, and I kept them in. It was kind of a profit sharing. But what that did was allow me to go up and start raising capital in New York, some of the capital partners you and I discussed, and say, look, I have a 20,000 unit portfolio of property management. We're managing we got boots on the ground from, you know, Virginia to Texas down to Florida, you know, and here's all the experience behind me. And I'm the guy out front doing deals and raising capital, things like that.
Was this a master plan when you started buying those companies, or did you just buy them because you thought you could get a good deal and it was a way to get into real estate in a bigger way?
It was a plan. I wouldn't call it a master plan, but it was, you know, I was not having a lot of success with meeting with these traditional private equity firms. And, you know, I would ask them, you know, why don't you want a partner? What's the problem? You know? And they said, look, you know, we partner with fully integrated firms. You know, we're used to partnering with groups that have property management, you know, construction, this, that, whatever. And so it was a way of me backing into what I thought they would want. And that led me to buy these property management companies. But at the time, it was a time like almost like right now where nobody was really doing deals on the property side. You know, it was really hard. There had been a downturn, but nobody was really desperately selling properties. And so I was looking for cash flowing assets. And, you know, these property management companies, you and I discussed it earlier, but I took these companies and I made them profit centers, you know, and I sharpened my pencil and really gave what I would consider strict, you know, orders to, hey, I want 20% profit margins. And I don't care if it can't be, it's never been done, and I want it done. And so we were able to do that and carry it on for, God, well over 10 years. So yeah, it was, it was a combination between a master plan, I would say, and just looking for reoccurring income streams.
What was it like basically doing a student housing deal, building some spec homes, kind of entrepreneurial one-off stuff, to jumping into overseeing 30,000 units?
It was wild. I mean, I remember going up to Greenville. That was where, so the biggest management company we bought was the second one. And actually, I think they had closer to like 12,000 units. And so I closed down the Atlanta office. I closed down, you know, the other office, and we moved the headquarters essentially to Greenville, South Carolina. And I remember being this young guy, just getting up in front of an office full of people, 100 some of people, and, you know, just going, shit, they're not even taking me seriously, you know? And it was a tough thing, but, you know, it was also really exciting. I mean, it made me feel like a boss, you know, it made me feel excited. And I think that motivated me. You know, a lot of people counting on me at that point, and I took that into consideration. I, you know, I had people now depending on me to grow the company so they could feed their families, pay their rent, you know, things like that. And I think that was a huge motivating factor, and also just a little bit of proving myself. You know, I came in and I, you know, kind of like this hotshot guy that had just bought all these companies and, you know, set all these big goals for the company. And I wanted to prove that out.
Did the PE firms that then started to do deals with you think that like you built it from scratch? They didn't care. They just wanted you to have 30,000 units. What was their perception? Because this is a wild story. Like, I've never heard of anyone getting into multifamily this way. And this is why I wanted to talk to you, man. It's awesome.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, I think the latter, what you said, like, I don't think they cared once they could get it past investment committee, right? Once it wasn't just, you know, here's this random guy, you know, that wants to partner with us. Once they could say, okay, he's got 30,000 units under management. All the senior executives have been doing this for, you know, 15 plus years. And this, by the way, this deal is great. I mean, like, I talked to a guy yesterday and he just wanted advice. And I'm like, man, as much as I'd like to tell you there's some secret sauce or whatever, it really comes down to the deal. You know, how good is the deal? And that almost takes precedent over everything. You know, if you can almost be a, like myself, you know, I'm from Tampa, Florida. I didn't go to college. You know, I didn't really check any of the traditional boxes. But, you know, when you started putting seven caps in front of Lubert Adler, Carlisle, Starwood, and the numbers just made sense. You know, we were buying off market deals. I remember we had a big multifamily developer, Davis Development, and he took a liking to me and literally, I think, sold us 13 deals over a year and a half. And so I think having really, really good deals and finding something that they can't just find themselves, like, people, you know, again, ask me for advice and they're like, yeah, you know, I'm bidding on all these broker deals and this, that, whatever. And it's like, what's the value in that? So I think the answer to your question is I had to check all the boxes, right? I knew I had to have the fully integrated company. I knew, you know, they were going to want to see some gray hairs around me. And, you know, I knew the deal had to be so good that it was just hard to say no to.
What was your criteria for determining whether a deal was special or not? Like, what were the key things that you would focus on?
Cash on cash return and replacement costs. I mean, at the time, we were buying deals from 100 to 120 a door, and the cash on cash was like 12, 13%. And so I was actually talking to one of my early investors, an individual, yesterday. And, you know, it's so funny. Now I'm like the old guy, but I was asking, I was like, you know, I remember when you first started investing with me, you know, these deals, I could say with a straight face, they were so good. Like, there was limited downside. Like, the downside was we got stuck with the deals and just clipped, you know, massive coupons, right? Like 12%. And the upside was clear to point to. I mean, you had real opportunities for rent growth. You had real opportunities for rent bumps from doing renovation, and the debt was manageable. So I think that's what our criteria was. Cash on cash returns. You know, I wanted to get paid. That's what I used to tell them. I want to get paid while we wait. And you're not just banking on, I mean, if you're used to seeing a spreadsheet, you know, I didn't want to just see nothing, nothing, nothing. And then year five, you get this windfall. You know, I wanted to have, if it wasn't some grand slam exit, it was still a good deal.
What people don't understand is that when you see a deal that someone's putting out there that's an 18 IRR and it goes like this, 5% cash on cash, 5% cash on cash, 5% cash on cash, everything is coming on the exit. You talk about Grant Cardone a lot. I looked at one or two of his deals, and that's like the underwriting. And for that to work, it's all going at the sale and everything has to go perfect. And you're basically timing the market.
God, I'm glad you saw his underwriting, because I almost would love to just be like, send me that deal sheet. Like, let me see this, because, you know, and the truth about a 5% cash on cash return, as you probably know too, that always gets gobbled up, right? There's always something that pops up, you know, and whatever. So you're really not getting any cash flow. You're not paying down debt. You're not, you know, what we did a lot with cash flow is pour it back into the unit. So instead of calling capital, we were funneling it back into the renovations, and that's really boosted our IRR when we sold. And we sold. We had the discipline to sell. You know, like you mentioned, Grant, I don't think that guy's ever sold anything. I sold him a deal, I think in 2014, in like Savannah, Georgia, or something like that. He probably still owns it. We were disciplined. Our average hold period, if you look at it, is 3.5 years. So I was really on our guys, you know, to get in, create value, and then ring the bell. If we could get a 2x or a 2x multiple, there was no way we were going to hold on to that deal. We wanted to sell and get, you know, investors back their money under the assumption that they would reinvest with us. And they did. You know, that was, I remember, you know, at first it was like, how do you convince joint venture capital to partner with you? And then as soon as you do that for a few years, you want to get a discretionary fund. And I remember we partnered with a group called Townsend, and they were like the gatekeepers for discretionary fund capital. And they said, listen, you guys have everything going for you. You check all the boxes, but before we can give you a discretionary fund or advice or recommend that, we're going to do like some partnerships with you guys. So they basically became our joint venture partner. And, you know, I always said, well, you know, we're good enough to sleep with it, but not good enough to marry. But, you know, they were, you know, great partners for us. I mean, I look back on everything and we really did. We had great partners. I think it was, you know, I was confident in myself, but I was also confident in our capital partners that we could say yes to a deal, even if we didn't have a discretionary fund, and I knew we'd get it financed. I mean, there was a deal that I did down here that was like a $240 million deal called the Resort at Pembroke Pines. And I said yes to it. We won the bid and it was a scramble. I think we had to come up with $50 million of equity. And, you know, at the time, interest rates were, the 10-year was 2.25%. I still remember it. And while we had that deal under contract, it shot up to like 250. And it was just like, it was a nail biter, but we got it done and ended up being a good deal. And so I think everybody gets hung up, at least we did too. Oh, we need to have a discretionary fund, all this stuff. Again, it goes back to the deal. If you have a good enough deal, you'll get it capitalized. I mean, I think there's always so much capital in the system, period, that, you know, that's looking for deals. If you have a good deal, you control the deal, you're going to get it capitalized, you know?
Were most of your deals coming through marketed processes, or were they coming through just your flow of owning a management company and being active?
I think 50%, because we used to, you know, in our pitch decks and things like that, we would market this, but 50% were coming off market. So either through recapitalizations, and a lot of times we recapped our own deals. You know, we would have a capital partner in there and we would have a deal 2 or 3 years with them. And they were our joint venture. And they say, you know what, let's sell. And we hadn't really done much of the renovation. We had just rode this rapid rent growth that was happening across the market. So we would go to a partner and say, hey, look, we got this deal. We control, you know, we're in the deal. We want to stay in it. And we would bring in a new joint venture partner. So, you know, that was a lot of them. And then just, you know, working relationships. I mean, like I said, we had that one developer partner, but others, I would go up to New York all the time and be meeting with capital partners. And sometimes they would say, you know, I remember Angelo Gordon one time I was meeting with them. They're like, shit, this deal just fell out of contract, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, we'll take it, you know? And so I think it's just, you got to be out there. You got to be networking constantly. You got to be pounding the pavement and letting people know that you got to be doing something differently. If everybody wants 30 days due diligence and 30 days to close, look, you got to do it in 15 days, right? You got to do something different. You got to make these, you know, sellers, you got to make these capital partners, you got to make them say yes. And, you know, that's the tricky part, but that's what gets people's attention. Like if you look at a broker deal and there's 30 people, and I think this is probably accurate, like 30 qualified buyers, right, that show up. How do you separate yourself? We all got the same underwriting. We all got the same bids from debt and things like that. So you got to separate yourself somehow.
And what was that for you? What was your competitive edge when you were competing with a bunch of groups in a brokered process?
Well, I think it was just figuring out what it took to stand out. I mean, each deal was kind of different. And we worked the brokers in a way. You know, we would say, hey, listen, if you award us this deal, you know, when it comes time to sell, we'll use you again to sell. So it was like, you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. But it was just, I think, trying to think constantly. How do you separate yourself? Is it closing sooner? Is it putting up hard, non-refundable money? Which, by the way, is refund. Like, you can always, you know, people always say, oh, non-refundable, blah, blah, blah. It takes 2 weeks to draw up a contract. It takes this, that, whatever. It's kind of like a bunch of BS. We would use it. And, you know, I had, you know, a good acquisitions team. I would always be aggressive and tell them, I don't, you know, do this, do whatever it takes. Boom, boom, boom. Because I knew if not, you were just going to be another group out there that didn't really stand out. I wanted us to be the biggest. I wanted us to be the best. And, you know, to do that, we had to separate ourselves. And you had to control deals. Like if you didn't have deals, who cared, right? Like you can have the best pitch in the world. You can have the best resumes in the world, right? You can have the best people working for you. But if you don't have any deal flow, who cares?
So I want to talk about scale and how as you started to scale and get, I mean, you started with 20 or 30,000 units, but as you started to get even bigger, how did what you started to buy and invest in also change?
Well, as we started to create scale, we pretty much shifted our strategy to buying portfolios. And I would say that really created liftoff on our business. I mean, I don't remember. Actually, I mean, look, we did one massive portfolio of like 12,000 units. And I remember getting the call from Prudential and it was like right before Christmas. And they were like, look, you guys think you can do this? And I was like, absolutely. And called my acquisitions team and said, listen, we got to get this done. And after we got that done, it really opened up brokers bringing us portfolios, our ability to do larger scale deals. And I think that differentiated us. I think it took us from kind of a regional firm that was buying one-off deals to a national firm that could buy big, big deals in scale. And this was even before, you know, Blackstone got into the market and started gobbling up everything. This was like, it was rare at the time to do big portfolios. I think it was us and Cortland that were doing them. And, you know, that just, it created a ton of scale. I mean, I think if you look at all the properties we bought, and it was over, it ended up being over 100,000 units we bought. A lot of that 2015 to 2018 period was portfolios. You know, I also, we were always hesitant, I think, or I was always hesitant to take on a new market, but eventually we would just bite the bullet and stick someone out there. So like Denver, for example, we can never get into Denver. And I think once we had a person out there, a regional person or an acquisitions person, then the brokers started taking us seriously. They saw that we were committed to that market. Same with Dallas. You know, I always wanted to be in Dallas and Austin and things like that. And I think me flying out there too, I mean, instead of just sending an acquisitions person or whatever, when I went out there, not to just pat my own back, but when I went out there, they said, okay, well, they're serious. They want to be in these markets. So, and we had to do, I mean, even more so than like Atlanta and North Carolina and Florida, to get into these new markets, we really had to go out on a limb. We had to do those things that I was talking about, like post, you know, non-refundable earnest money. We had to close quick. We had to do this, do that. One of that deal I talked about Angelo Gordon was in Houston. And we had never done a deal in Houston or in Texas or whatever. And like, that was a fortuitous type opportunity, you know, because it was a deal that we controlled. We didn't have to bid on it. And it got us in Texas. So I think that's how we created scale, getting one deal, two deals done in a new market. And then that allowed us either going back to portfolios and say, hey, look, we've bought in these markets before, or being able to get deals and say, hey, look, we already own in this market. So I think when we expanded geography, that helped us expand scale.
Can you go deeper on that 12,000 unit deal, the first one? Like, how did that come about? Like, what's this whole story?
Yeah, it's called Bedrock. And it was a massive portfolio, again, out in the market. I want to say it was 2018 or 2017 that we bought it. And again, it was before Blackstone got to the market. It was before Starwood was gobbling up everything. And I remember, you know, the broker telling me, because we obviously wanted to do it. And he was like, well, you know, Prudential is looking at this portfolio. And so we toured it with Prudential. I remember Alfonso Monk, who became a friend. He's still a friend. He's the CIO of Hines now. But I remember we started touring all these properties, and they were like 80s vintage, nothing sexy at all. And I just remember my job was to make friends with Alfonso, because he was the CIO. He was the one making decisions. And I don't think I even looked at the real estate. It was just, I need to make this guy laugh. I need to be his friend and whatever. And like us, and then Jim Mahalso was kind of their head of acquisitions. And I remember he called me and was like, look, can you guys get these done? It was 26 different properties. And I was like, yes, sir. You know, let's go. And we got them done. It was a scramble. Ended up being the best deal I've ever done in my life. And yeah, that's what it was.
Why was it the best deal?
Big value add portfolio throughout the Sun Belt.
So what was so good about it? The fact that it was in the Sun Belt, that you could create value through renovations, like what ended up being the best part?
It was a cash cow. I mean, we put, ridiculously cheap debt on it. And so right out of the gate, it was like a 12 or 13% cash on cash return. But I think just timing, I mean, from the time we bought it to the time we sold it, cap rates probably came in 150 to 200 basis points.
Wow.
And so you just had this massive lift in value. And it was the buyer was able to look at it and say, okay, there's still a lot of meat on the bone. We can, you know, do a lot of renovations, things like that. And for us, it was just the perfect timing. Like I said, it was cash flow heavy the whole time, which, you know, really helped our IRR. you know, because we were hitting our pref and then also paying down equity. And we just had a massive exit, you know, when I think it was sub 3 cap, you know,
and
like, yeah, the good old days.
Yeah. Hopefully they come back. It's too long. It feels like we're, a lot of people are sitting around. I mean, I'm in hospitality, but it feels a little stagnant. We did a lot of deals during COVID, very tactical, unique opportunities, but now everyone is just kind of frozen in place. Is it like that way in multi as well?
Yeah, it is. You know, as part of selling my management and asset management company, I have a non-compete, but I still talk to everybody. I still hang around the rim. And yeah, it's totally stagnant. It's impossible right now because you can borrow, look, you're borrowing at like 4.5 something, and nobody's willing to sell at a 7 cap. And that was kind of the math we did. I mean, if we could borrow at 2, we were buying at 4, 3.5, 4. I wanted to see 150 basis points, 200 basis points above our borrowing costs. And then if we were going in at a 4 cap, we put on our 5-year exit a 5.5 cap. So we were conservatively saying, okay, interest rates or cap rates are probably going to expand over time, not compress. And, you know, because we thought interest rates were going to go up. And so it was really a conservative way to underwrite. You know, you had in-place cash flow, and you were mitigating risk by saying, look, cap rates are probably going to expand. And I think right now to get a deal to pencil, you would have to say, okay, interest rates are going to come down. So I'm buying it maybe a 5 cap, but you know, interest rates are going to come down. I'm going to be able to sell at a 3 cap. And that's just, I don't think investors are willing to take that risk.
I want to go back to what you were saying about the management company and that being profitable, because like we were talking earlier, a lot of multi-management companies are not profitable, or the people say they're not profitable. But if you were targeting profitability, that also gave you income, so you didn't have to feel forced to do every single deal or do a bad deal. What was the kind of the things that you were doing to turn on the profitability?
Well, what you said is exactly right. Like we didn't have a gun to our head to do deals. You know, we always had cash flow, and all our acquisition fees we left in the deal. So it was like we weren't taking money off the table at closing. So there was a real alignment of interest. What did we do people will go to what their expectations are. You know, if you say, I need this, figure it out, I think that's the direction people went in. I didn't have the fanciest office, right? We didn't have crazy salaries that a lot of our competitors were paying. I mean, I was afraid that our people would hear about those salaries and bang on me. I kept salaries low and paid pretty high bonuses. And that was kind of my way of saying, hey, look, when we win, we all win together, but we got to keep this a lean, you know, well-oiled machine. And that's what we did. And as profits started coming in, you know, as promotes started coming in, as fees grew, we didn't get ahead of our skis. You know, we didn't. Again, we just kept it a lean mindset, and it became kind of a thing that just I expected and my CFO made happen.
When you were meeting with these institutional groups, what was it like meeting with a private equity guy when you're an entrepreneur, you have the weight of a business on your shoulder, they don't, they're getting paid no matter what? What was it like getting deals done with kind of oil and water? I mean, you're completely different from the guys that you were partnering with.
It was awesome. You know, it was like, I totally felt like an outsider. You know, I'd go to these offices and they'd be overlooking Central Park. And it was like so intimidating on one hand, but I also could tell that they were attracted to what I brought to the table in some way, right? That I was okay with being a little out there different than them, and that I was going to do whatever it took to make these deals work and find new deals and things like that, that I wasn't, you know, just a cookie cutter deal guy. And that's what it worked. I mean, I was willing to hop on a plane when others I don't think would. I was willing to go drive properties on the weekend. I was willing to do whatever it took. And I think it was a big part of proving myself, you know, like I was very intimidated to go in and know these guys went to Wharton or Harvard or wherever. And, you know, it was very, you know, I remember every time I'd go down those elevators and feel like I had a great meeting, it was just the best feeling in the world. So I think it was a huge motivating factor.
How did you figure out how to get deals though across the finish line, or were they just begging you to do the deals? Because a lot of the times with PE, you know, they've got committees and all these layers of bullshit. Like, how did you actually start to get stuff done with them?
Man, again, the best, it came down to the deal. Lubert Adler did our first deal. And then I would kind of play them against each other and be like, look, if you don't want to do this deal, Carlisle's going to do it. Somebody else is going to do it. And I think that helped, right? Like the kind of scarcity or fear that they may lose the deal. But it was just, I think I was relentless. And I think, you know, we 100% every one of our deals had a last minute blow up, had a last minute, oh my God, it's not going to get done. I remember I had, you know, like a DUI when I was like 20 years old or something like that. And 100% of the time, investment committee would pull my background and see that and be like, oh my God, you know, and it was just like, we just had to get them done. You know, we just had to. And I remember, I know you couldn't do this now with everybody so afraid of aggression, but I would scream at these guys. I would like, what do you mean? You know, this, that, whatever. And I think it was a combination between, you know, before that time, no one really looked at multifamily as an institutional asset class. You know, people were investing in hospitality, office buildings, things like that. And so I think it was a combination that behind the scenes, their bosses were saying, we want to make investments in multifamily. So they were getting pressure to do deals. And it just was like the perfect storm. You know, it was us pushing these deals. And it was them looking to deploy capital and going, all right, fuck it. You know, we're going to do it. But it really was. It was, we will answer any one of your questions. Come on. Like, you know, I had a good acquisitions guy, head of acquisitions, Josh Champion. He had worked at he'd worked at Prudential before in the debt origination side. So we would really have our deals buttoned up pretty good. Our underwriting was tight. Our debt quotes were tight. And so I always wanted to have the best, you know, deck or pitch deck or whatever. When we'd send a deal, I wanted the best fit pitchers. I wanted the best financial projections. I wanted it to look perfect. And I would go through it. And literally, if a comma was out of the way or out of the place, I would jump all over it. And so I think we did a really good job. I mean, I think our core values were focus, integrity, ambition, and excellence. And so I wanted it to be perfect. I wanted these guys, you know, in New York to be impressed and want to do these deals. So I think other than like the last minute fire drills that probably happen in every real estate deal, you know, they were excited about doing these deals. And then once we got one or two done, I mean, it was like floodgates are open.
How did you approach negotiation? What's your negotiation style? Maybe a little aggression. What are the other tricks?
Grab your ankles. I mean, if you know, we were doing 95-5 deals and, you know, they were putting up 95% of the capital. So negotiations were very difficult. I approached them, I would say, in a way that, hey, look, I'm your partner. I don't want to get into a pissing match, you know, before we start this deal. And so I would actually slate the deal that if we did well, we'd have more of the upside, but maybe not take as big of an acquisition fee, maybe make it more back ended, which ended up being very good. But I think if you're outmatched, it's like the art of war, right? If you're outmatched, you know, you're not going to win. It's stupid to fight. And so, you know, when you're competing against these institutions and they really have all the leverage, you know, you've got to kind of play into that. And then, you know, I will say we ended up getting some leverage as we grew, because we would send packages out to do these deals to like 8 equity partners, and 4 of them would say yes. So I think I'd play a little bit of good cop, bad cop, and, you know, let our acquisitions team get it as far as they could. And then I'd go back for one more kind of bite at the apple. But, you know, I think you got to kind of understand what position you are in to negotiate. And I was never what I would call a chiseler or anything like that. I kept in mind what I thought was things that I had to have. And, you know, I told them, I would say, listen, I've got to be able to pay my team. I've got to be able to pay my employees. So if your proposal on doing this deal is no fees and no this, you know, our conversation's over, but we want to work together and things like that. And like I said, I would try to back in the negotiations and say, hey, look, if we get your money back, this, that, whatever, instead of an 80-20, let's do a 60-40 or something like that. But yeah, the negotiations were kind of one-sided.
You were spending a lot of time in New York, and I think you were trying to be like top of mind for these guys and not just showing up when you had a deal. Can you kind of talk about what you were doing and why that was important?
It was mainly to get away from my wife at the time. No, it was very much, look, I wanted to pop in on these guys. And like you said, be top of mind. So I would pop in and be like, listen, here's what I'm seeing in Houston. Here's what I'm seeing in Dallas. Here's what I'm seeing in, you know, Raleigh, North Carolina, and really just kind of be a value add resource and not be asking for anything, you know, and knowing that, you know, in the background that, you know, my deal team was probably sending them deals or whatever, but, you know, I would go by and just talk shop. And really, I loved it, because if I met with like 8 groups in one day, in which I was, I would come away and be like, with a theme, being like, okay, well, damn, everybody wants Raleigh, North Carolina. Everybody wants Charlotte. Everybody wants Tampa, Florida. And so, you know, it was a great, great use of time. And I, you know, I got to credit one of my early, you know, individual kind of family office investors who said, Pat, have your ass up in New York every 2 weeks, because it was kind of a speed dating type exercise. Like, I wasn't trying to take up all their time. So I was in and out in probably 20 or 30 minutes. And it was just a brainstorming session. There was no specific deal I was pitching. There was no ask. It was just, hey, let's talk about the market. Let's talk about, you know, what you guys are looking for, what I'm seeing as opportunities. And so, you know, let's talk about bullshit. Let's just be friends. You know, it was really just about making those relationships, keeping them front of line. I mean, I remember I walked out of once or twice, and I would see, I think I saw Stephen DeFrancis from Cortland. I was like, ah, shit. You know, like, I didn't want to see any of my competitors up there. And, you know, so it was like, I wanted to control those relationships, and I wanted to be the only, you know, person they thought of when they thought about doing deals in the Sun Belt.
So you're doing 95-5, 90-10. Were you personally putting up the capital for the 5 and the 10? Were you kind of putting some family offices in there? How did that come together?
I did the first 6 deals. I put up the capital for the first 6 deals because I had money left over from selling the student housing deal.
Wow, that must have been a great deal. You bought management companies, you're investing in deals, home run.
I made like $8 or $9 million. I remember it was like, you know, I was like probably 27 years old. It was a huge deal. So after that, after like 5 or 6 of those deals, I raised a co-invest fund, which it was nothing more than, you know, what they call country club equity. It was some wealthy guys, and they chipped in 250 or 500 grand. And, you know, we did that, quickly deployed that, and did another one and did another one. And so we did, I want to say, like 3 just high net worth country club equity funds. And then I did a partnership with a group called Silver Peak. Mm-hmm. Great guys, Mark Walsh, Chris Westfold. And I swear, I think we did like 19 or 20 deals with those guys where they were putting up like 80 something percent of the co-invest capital. And we were putting up the 20% or whatever. And we rolled our acquisition fees. It was doubling down, doubling down, doubling down. Now that I look at it, it was a lot of just doubling down and robbing Peter to pay Paul, to be honest with you. And then, you know, after the partnership with Silver Peak, we did a partnership with Townsend, and we raised 100 something million big boy institutions like Ford's endowment, things like that. And that gave us a pretty big war chest for co-invest capital. That's what it was for. We were able to do like three or four deals, 100% our equity, but really it was to rocket fuel our acquisitions program. So we could go in and do, instead of 5% scrambling for it, we could do 5 to 15%. If it was a good enough deal, we could do more portfolios, things like that.
Was the reason you didn't focus on just Country Club Capital for the whole thing because it wasn't going to give you enough scale and give you the rocket fuel, and basically they couldn't keep up with your growth?
Yeah, 100%. And I just was not great. I mean, I had great mentors, and I still do. But some of these guys, I'm not a country club guy. And so I wasn't going to be taking them to play golf and kissing their ass and things like that. You know, the business was moving so fast, things like that. And I just wanted to be big, and I wanted it to be a real business. And I didn't want it to be a mom and pop. You know, I wanted it to be, you know, a big, big business. I looked at companies like Related, Graystar, Tishman Speyer, things like that. And that's what I wanted. You know, I didn't want to have, there's other companies I could name, I'm not going to name, but they had, you know, all kind of retail-ish investors. And that just, it just seemed lower brow to me.
How much time did you spend thinking about like your personal reputation and your brand as you were building this into a very large firm?
A lot. I mean, up to a couple of years ago used to say to me, man, I still get your email blasts or whatever. So like starting back in 2011 or 12, like I say as a joke, if I showed up at the office on time, I'd do an email blast. That was like back before social media and everything like that. And certainly when we close a deal, we'd do an email blast. If we had a new partnership, we'd do an email blast. And so again, it was front of mind, stay front of mind, front of mind. And, you know, on the branding side, we came up with a brand for our properties, and it was Arium, but we put Carol on everything. And I wanted it to look as big of a firm as it possible. And I thought branding was important for that. I mean, it was like, we want to look like, you know, the Ford Motor Company, the GE of real estate. You know, we don't want to be looked at as this entrepreneurial startup. And so a lot of effort went into branding, a lot of effort went into marketing. I copied competitors' websites that were a lot bigger than ours, you know, and that was, it was important because, you know, people looks count. And when you show up and meet with these groups, if you have what they're used to seeing, you know, and from a brand, and you have a strong brand, it was important. And hiring employees, you know, like people want to work for brands. You know, I'll tell you, like it can work both ways, right? If you have a slip up in your brand and whatever, it's certainly harder, you know, and especially now that I think with social media or whatever, you know, people are just looking for a reason to say negative things. But when we were building the company, branding was very, very important.
You had a very specific strategy. It was basically buy it, fix it, sell it. Can you talk a little bit about what that means and how you would execute?
Yeah. I mean, buy it, obviously, is buy it. We'd focus on a very strict criteria. So, and we would lay it out in our pitch book. We would lay it out for investors. Here's what we're looking for. We want to be 10 to 15% below replacement costs, which works out to basically this per unit. We want minimum this cash on cash return going in. And, you know, and these are the markets, right? We would say we're not looking just at markets. We're looking at sub markets. So it's one thing to say Raleigh, North Carolina. It's another thing to say Research Triangle. You know, like we want to be in this part of Raleigh, North Carolina. And so that's what we were. We were very specific on what we were buying. You know, fixing, we had a model like competitors of ours, you know, Cortland, things like that. They were going in and doing massive renovations, like $20,000 or $30,000 at the time a unit. Our model was different. We wanted to do it quick. We didn't want to empty out properties. So we would do it on the turn. And we were doing like $3,000 or $4,000 a unit, which was a model we had down packed. You know, it was doing the kitchens, it was doing the bathrooms, and it was doing basically cosmetic things to the clubhouse and curb appeal. And then sell it. We were just disciplined on selling. And it was painful at times, right? It was painful to go, okay, we're selling 7 deals this quarter. It's going to be a huge hit to our property management fee stream and whatever, but we're going to make it work. And so I think buy it, fix it, sell it. We were adamant on it. It was a great strategy. I mean, I think a year later, John Gray came and stole that, not from us, but his same strategy. But like, yeah, that's what it was. So buy it, fix it, sell it. And everything we did, I wanted to have a formula for it. I mean, I remember I still seen it not long ago, a video I did where it's like, we want to be the best, but what does that mean? You know, like everybody says we're the best. How do you define that? And so everything we did, I wanted to have a backup for. Like, why, you know, we buy it. Well, what are you going to buy? Fix. What does that mean? Define it, and get it, make a business plan around it and make it measurable.
If you're doing a few units at a time, how did you scale that? Are you like buying a bunch of bulk kitchens and supplies and all this stuff and having them ready? And do you have these like crews that run around to all your properties? Like, how did you figure out how to do that part of it?
Not really. Well, 50%, and I don't know if it's, I assume it's the same now, but 50% of the units turn over every year. 50% of your residents move out every year. So, you know, we were doing a decent amount, but the things that we would buy in bulk were like GE washer dryers, you know, things like that. And we would have enough volume and our suppliers would know we were buying enough. You know, we went through supply companies, but, and so we were getting good volume discounts. That's why I never really understood companies, you know, that were buying and warehousing stuff and things like that. I mean, the money you saved was not that. You know, this is all pre-COVID, right? Like, so I think COVID had a big hit on supply chain, but, you know, we were never in a situation where we couldn't get paint or washer dryers or flooring or whatever. You know, I think it was readily available and I didn't want to put a nickel of capital to work unless it was working. And so the idea of tying up equity with product sounded stupid to me. If we put in a nickel, I wanted it going to renovation. I wanted it to do that, this, that, whatever. And we would do that. We would say, okay, we're putting in $3,000 a unit. We want a 25% return on that. We're putting a kitchen in and I would have them measure out the return on equity on that. And so every nickel, every dollar we put in was working for us.
I don't think enough people do that. I think most people just say we're going to spend $10,000 on this unit and they don't really look at the ROI and they probably don't do as well as you. I remember we were looking at a deal from Blackstone and they fixed up this hotel, but they left all the annoying shit for the next guy because anyone buying a deal will always convince themselves that there's going to be less work or it's going to cost less than it actually is. What were some of the things that you would see like your competitors doing that you would just stay away from, like making mistakes on the renovation side?
Yeah, well, on the renovation side, it was kind of like that. It was kind of like, we've got this construction group, we got to put them to work, right? Or we raised this much money and we got to spend it. That's the most ridiculous thing in the world. Like we would budget for, you know, doing X amount of renovations. And if rents were just going up organically, which they were at the time a lot, we'd sit on that money. You know, we wouldn't have a gun to our head to invest that money or to do that renovation, right? Like, if people were still willing to continually pay higher and higher rents, okay, you know, I'm not going to go in there and fix up their kitchens and things like that if I don't have to. But I think the biggest thing, I mean, even my house, I've noticed, but like the biggest thing I would notice is people that didn't maintain their properties, it was a disaster. It was such a disaster. We'd take over these properties and just to get them back to par was tough. And so I think it's, you know, we always did a good job at being disciplined and maintaining our properties and keeping them up to speed. And that's something I would not skimp on. But also, if even if we had raised a gazillion dollars to do renovations, if we didn't have to do those renovations, we wouldn't. But if somebody in our submarket or comparable was in there pushing rents because they were upgrading their kitchens, we certainly would. But again, like if they weren't and the rents were just going up, we would not. We would sit on that money. You know, every equity dollar that you call from capital partners starts that IRR clock.
And the fact that you were selling deals in 3 years, it's just ultimately likely going to lead to a higher IRR if you're doing the right things. But one of the most amazing things about what you were doing is you were willing to sacrifice some management company value by losing some management fees for selling an asset and not being afraid to do that.
I was afraid, but you know, I just had this, I mean, it's hard for me actually. Like I was talking to a partner of mine yesterday and I'm like, damn, will there ever be a time like that? Like I look back and I'm like, you know, some of the decisions I was making were ballsy decisions. And like, I remember how fearful and how scared a lot of our employees were when they're like, wow, we're losing 2,000 units. And I just had a feeling like we're going to make it up. We're going to buy even more. We're going to, every year I would set almost unrealistic goals. Like we're going to buy 10,000 units and they would be like, yeah, right. And I remember I'd be outside smoking a cigar or something and I would be writing these goals and I would just be like, you know, we can do this. And it's almost like if you put your mind to it, it happens. And, you know, my whole life has kind of been like that. And, you know, it had a way of working out. We would be in the market with tons of properties to sell. And I guess if you think about it, it's that front of mind thing. We were buying so much. We were selling so much. We were everywhere. We were marketing ourselves. And so it probably pissed a lot of our competitors off. But again, private equity guys were touring deals and it was Carol's deals they were selling. And then we were buying deals. We were putting deals in front of them. And so it was almost creating this momentum that everybody wanted to be part of it.
What was your process for setting goals? Would you like write things down? Is this like an annual thing, a quarterly thing, 3 years? Like how would you do that?
All the above. I would set annual goals and then break them down to quarterly. This was like, I would do it, I remember, between, you know, the end of the year and Christmas, you know, Christmas break, I'd be doing this and I would present it to my management team and be like, here we go. But I also had 3 and 5 year goals that, again, just seemed unrealistic. If you think back on it, we were this piss ant company at the time in like 2012, 2013. And I was like, fuck it, we're going to buy 10,000 units. You know, we're going to, you know, do this, we're going to do that. And, you know, we're going to make this much in acquisition fees. We're going to make this much in promote. And again, it just had a way of coming together. And I should probably take that advice now. but yeah, man, I would set, they call them stretch goals, but wow, they were even more than stretch. But I think, yeah, I would lay it out by amount of units we'd buy. I'd lay it out by, you know, I wanted the property management business to grow by X amount. I was very, very specific on it. And, you know, my team would then take those goals and work it into our annual budget. And so it was kind of like, we're making this happen. You know, like if we don't, we got, you know, we're screwed. We just did that, you know, and we were actually really conservative, though, on the budget. So I think, you know, on the top line, we'd be more conservative than we were on the bottom line. So like my CFO, she was great. She would go and take what I was projecting as far as losing contracts, selling properties, and, you know, less aggressive, though, on the top side. So again, I think that's a way, too, that we really bootstrapped a lot. And again, I can't stress enough. I mean, I think of a lot of my competitors that had multiple offices. They had these, the saying I told you earlier, is it better to be king or is it better to be rich? I wanted to be rich. And like, you know, like I didn't need to have an office in Dallas, Charlotte, Denver, and all that crap. Like, you know, we'd have those dots on the map, but it was really regional managers that were working out of clubhouses and properties we owned. You know, we had one real office in Atlanta, Georgia, and we were paying $22 a square foot.
Love it. How much of your success during that time was attributable to like timing and cycle? And were you thinking about that or were you just like going with it?
80%, no, not at least 50% was timing and cycle. You know, you're actually, these questions are reminding myself, I did do a lot of good things. I had a good business plan. I was disciplined. I think I had, you know, a good way of looking out 3 to 5 years and articulating that strategy. But I mean, you can't discredit the fact that literally starting in like 2012, cap rates went down, right? Rents went up, cap rates went down. And so that was perfect. What I thought was happening with the cycle is I got nervous a lot earlier. So I thought in 2017, 2018, mm-hmm. I remember in 2018, I moved to Florida because I was like, shit, I'm going to fish and I'm going to have lower taxes because, you know, this market is too hot. And it ran another 3 years. And so I think we were doing deals that I thought were overpriced kind of later in the cycle that ended up working. So I think that's my takeaway is like, you know, cycles last longer than they should, and they're probably down longer than they should. You know, I think people get so burned at the top of the market that they stay out of the market too long. We were doing a lot of deals in 2011, 12, 13, and people that got burned didn't really hop back in until 15, 16, 17, 18. And so again, I think they call it the herd mentality. These guys plowing at the end and miss a lot of the upside coming back in. I don't know if that's happening right now. I don't really think so. But surely there's going to be a window of time where there's really, really good deals to be had and the institutions are still on the sidelines.
They're definitely still on the sidelines, but I think they're desperately waiting for someone like you to come around and tell them it's time to jump in because I have this whole infrastructure. I have this data. I can see what's going on because I don't, other than Blackstone, it doesn't seem like a lot of these guys are going to jump on their own. They need someone to take them to a deal.
That's a good point. I mean, that's why, like you asked, like, how'd I feel as kind of this scrappy, I guess, entrepreneur versus these guys that, you know, went to their business schools and this, that, whatever. And it was almost like they needed to have that nudge, right? Like, boom, hey, it's right here, 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 here. And that's what they needed. You know, it's like, you know, they're so used to being part of that herd. And I wish I had another good idea right now. But I think it'll come, you know, and I think people on the ground are going to see it before the people sitting in the ivory towers. You know, that's what makes business great, right? Like, I think that's the name of the game, at least in the finance and real estate, right? It's entrepreneurs that go to Wall Street and look for capital to scale their business. And, you know, that was the most fun, I think, out there. It's like finding opportunities and then finding a way to capitalize them. And I think that's another piece of advice I got was, somebody told me, like, you know, there's a lot of people that can do real estate deals, but you want to be the best at finding the capital. And so I think that was true. I mean, there was no deal that I saw or as far as size or whatever that I didn't think I could get capitalized. And so it gave me a huge, competitive advantage. Like, I think my other, competitors, maybe outside Cortland, were afraid to raise their hands for billion-dollar deals and things like that. And, I just wasn't. I knew somehow we were going to get the capital. I knew I had been told by so many of these partners that, oh, man, big, bigger is better, blah, blah, blah. And it was just, it was a lot of fun. And it was like, they call it the leap of faith. It was like doing it, it was definitely an adrenaline high. But yeah, I mean, again, the groups that are on the ground are going to see things start to shift. And, the problem is right now, like I still have friends in the industry. I still talk to a lot of people. No one's really seeing that right now. The properties are doing okay. Your supply is creeping in a little bit, but there is no, big opportunity yet. And so I think people are trying to figure out where's that's going to come. But I do think the entrepreneur, the people that have that hunger in their belly are going to be the ones to tip the capital off.
We're going to talk about your big transaction at the end of last cycle. But as we are coming into that last cycle, you're living in Miami. At what point do you stop doing deals? And like, how did you figure out that you wanted to pause? What happened?
What year are we talking about?
I don't know. When did you stop?
Yeah. I mean, I think, well, it was like probably 2021-ish, 2022. And yeah, it was like right after COVID. I think seeing my investors start to pause, I think the deal was getting so aggressive, aggressively priced, meaning you would have these groups you never heard of, XYZ, Joe Blow, whoever, that were paying like crazy prices. And it was just like, you know what? We've done really, really well. If they want them, they can have them. In fact, let's sell to them. So I think when I started seeing craziness happen, that's when I really started pounding on our partners to sell. I mean, I think over a 3-year period, we sold like $3 billion worth of deals, and it was all kind of top of the market type stuff. And, it was just, I think it sounds easier than it is, but like Warren Buffett says, when your competitors are greedy, you should be scared. And when, when they're scared, you should be greedy. And so that was kind of, I think, what I felt like we were bidding on deals. And I was calling my acquisitions guys and going, what the hell? Why aren't we getting any deals done? And they were like, so-and-so just paid up 2.5 cap. And I'm like, fuck, let them have it. And, it was just, it was craziness. And like I said, it was a couple of years even prior that I was thinking things were getting heated. And so it just was like, this can't go on, and let's sell. And I remember like thinking to myself, man, this is just going to slowly dwindle down, and you're going to sell off all your properties and not have a company. And that was kind of a scary feeling, And I remember talking to some of my mentors and things like that. And they're like, look, man, if that happens, you're not going to have anything to worry about. But it took, it took a different turn. We started selling properties and ended up ultimately selling the platform,
Let's talk about it. First of all, I don't think people, A, give you enough credit and appreciate how hard it is to create equity in a real estate management company. I'm not talking about the real estate properties. I'm talking about the management company, because it's often tied to deals which could sell. It's tied to the founder, but you did it. You sold. So what made you want to sell? And then maybe just talk about the story and how it all came about.
Yeah. So I always wanted, I would read about these entrepreneurs selling their business and things like that. And so much of my net worth, I felt, was tied to my company. And so I always wanted to, as I'm, sitting in my backyard trying to figure out what my net worth was, I always wanted to be able to put some type of value on it. And so the way to do that, you know, I would read Blackstone's financial reports mm-hmm. and the way they would value their company would be multiple on fee income and then some type of multiple on carried interest or just carried interest. And so 4 or 5 years prior to selling the platform, I was valuing it. You know, I was saying, okay, our fee income, if you put a some type of multiple on it, is worth this. And then our carry is worth this. And so I think early on, I was in my head going, this has value. And then I started seeing asset management companies selling, right? Like there was some big trades where fund management platforms started getting sold.
Starwood sold 20%.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I was, and I always, when I was up meeting with equity, I would always meet with investment bankers. Like I had great friends and advisors, you know, at all the big B of A, Goldman, UBS, you know, I always met with them. And even though like they weren't like, I wasn't doing bond offerings, I wasn't really doing anything, but I would pick their brain on like the value of management platforms and things like that. And so I always kept that in mind. And I think that's why I wanted to have a profit margin and things like that. But I always broke out our components. So I had property management income, asset management income, construction management, asset management. I would break all those out. You know, I wouldn't just lump it all in. And I wanted it all to be profitable. So if somebody came along, if I handed off the keys and somebody came along and bought that without doing any deals, they'd be making money off it, right? It was like a viable fee stream. And I think that's what interested the buyer. I had heard that there were several buyers that were looking to create scale. And I'll tell you, like, I just got fatigued with having 1,000 employees. You know, it was a really difficult time. It was like coming out of COVID, you know, it was a grind. And the idea of potentially being able to sell the platform was just interesting and just exciting. And, you know, like I said, I read so many books on entrepreneurs that built profitable companies and sold them off. I think I always wanted to do that. And so, you know, when I interviewed some bankers and, you know, UBS was excited to do it, I was like, wow, this is real. You know, this might happen. Yeah. I can't say too much about it, but it was a great outcome.
Yeah. It was big number. And did it include like the carry or was that separate? How did that all come into play?
Carry was separate. I kept all the carry. I kept all my GP investments. So I still am heavily invested in all those deals. From a personal standpoint, it was 100% of the fee business. So what I talked about, multiples on the property management, asset management, construction management, et cetera, acquisition. It was multiple on that. And so it was a good deal for both sides. Like they are prolific at raising capital. And so they were in every different asset class except multifamily. And like I said, I had met with investment banks over the years and I'd heard this group's name or Mars name a few times. And they were like, look, they're looking to get into multifamily. They're this, they're that, they're. And at the time, the notion of selling my business was just never an option. So much of my personal identity was mm-hmm. tied up in that business. And, you know, I was like, what the fuck would I do? That's like my baby. And I don't know, man. It all came together. And for me, it was good timing. For them, I think good timing. And now I'm 45 years old. Now I got to figure out the next play.
What did it feel like?
Felt good. I mean, I think relief. I think, you know, but like I said, I had run that business for, I think, 17 years. And so not having to worry about every little thing being scrutinized by one of your 1,000 employees or, you know, if you run a red light, somebody, you know, wanting to say negative things about you or whatever. It just seemed like every day I was seeing something in the news about some high profile business guy and it was like, wow, there's this movement out there that's trying to take down, you know, anybody that's out there that's successful. And so I was fearful. I didn't like that. I didn't like that you could work decades creating all this value and, you know, something that happens on your personal side, I mean, could affect that. I think business is business and no one's perfect. And if you have some issues on your personal side, I mean, me personally, I went through a nasty divorce and it got publicized and I was like, how is that affecting my business? And so I was relieved. I think it got me back to being an entrepreneur. It got me back from being this corporate person that I become to, I think, where I feel more comfortable, which is more nimble, able to kind of move at my own pace too.
When you were about to sign the agreement of sale, was there someone or people you called to be like, should I do this? What do you think? Because you talked a lot about mentors. Were they involved in the decision?
They were, but like, this is something that I just knew I had to make the decision myself. And I talked every day with the banker. She was awesome, Bethany. You know, I talked to some of my lawyers a lot. My lawyers out of Atlanta, King & Spalding, were awesome. And I'd used them for 10 plus years. So I talked a lot to them. But the thing about mentors is they can only advise you on things that they've done. So, you know, I kind of outgrew some of my mentors. And so when I was looking at doing a deal like this, they couldn't really give me advice on it because they hadn't done anything like this. And so I think that was the hard part. I was so used to picking up the phone and calling mentors and being like, you know, what do you think here? What do you think there? And this and that. And this one was a big corporate transaction and I was kind of flying solo.
So you've had an unbelievable opportunity to sit back with incredible liquidity and evaluate the current landscape, the current opportunities. Where is your head at right now? What are you thinking about what's going on today in real estate?
It's frustrating, right? It's frustrating. Just like everybody's frustrating, it's frustrated. You know, I think real estate's my passion. I love real estate. I love, you know, everything about it, but it's an asset class that is completely, reliant on leverage, you know, like OPM. And if you can't borrow, positive leverage, it doesn't work. And so I think where my head is outside of multifamily, there's going to be a massive situation in the office market, right? What kind of situation it is, I don't know. But like you go up to New York City and everything in the Midtown, everything that's been built in the 70s and all that 80s is functionally obsolete, you know? And so as I read about everybody having to have their employees come back to work, which I didn't think was going to happen. I mean, I remember Facebook made an announcement several years ago, we're going work from home forever, which I was like, damn, that's aggressive. But now that everybody's coming back to office, which I kind of thought was going to happen, it'll be interesting to see. I think office is an interesting opportunity. Like if you can buy something so cheap that is essentially left for dead and rent it at a price where you can still make some money off of it, it kind of is like what multifamily was when it was just in the early stages, right? It's like you can get paid to wait and good things could happen, right? Cap rates could drop, this, that, whatever. I just think I don't want to tell myself that, well, that's not your strategy, you know, your specialty, because real estate's real estate. It's profit and loss, right? I think you can fit in location. So I've spent some time looking at that. Industrial, I think, is interesting, but it's the same problem as multi, right? Like it's cap rates are still low and debt is high and there is some overbuilding. It's tough. You know, it's tough. I was happy to be invested in the stock market this year. So I set up a family office and that's been keeping me occupied. But frankly, having to sit on my hands and having to do what a lot of other people are doing and not force deals. And it's like multifamily. You can even pick anybody off the street and say, hey, is industrial a good opportunity? And you'd say, yeah. But when you really look at the numbers, you know, cap rates are still low and interest rates are pretty high. So it's hard to make sense out of investments, right? So it's kind of waiting to see what gives. If somebody has debt coming due and, you know, wants to or has to sell, that could be an interesting opportunity period, because I think long-term industrial is going to make more and more sense as people shop from home and things like that. But it's really a lot of, I set up a family office that's been keeping me somewhat busy, but it's really just trying to have discipline and observe. You know, this is probably the first time in my life that I haven't had to make something happen. And I'm trying to use that to my advantage. I'm trying to say, okay, the people that have to make something happen, right? If you're carrying a platform with 15, 20 acquisitions people, that's a lot of mouths to feed. And, you know, let them force deals. Let them have to make something happen. Stay nimble and kind of wait to see what happens. And that's what I'm trying to do. I read all the real estate rags, like Green Street and everything like that, and just trying to see what's going to happen, but really just observing and waiting to see how these next couple of years play out. I guess I have a non-compete that I'm going to abide by. And, you know, I think just watching how things play out. I mean, it's been so interesting to see the transformation of multifamily from when I first started it, you know, started in it, to now. It's so huge. It's like a massive asset class and institutional, and you have all these pensions. I think I would see, you know, stuff about the institutional equity, and it used to be like 40% office and this, that, whatever. And you saw multifamily really tick up in their allocation. So it'll be interesting to see if investors that haven't gotten their returns from later vintage deals, if they say, screw this and go back to office or cycle out of real estate. You know, I think the institutional equity moves the market so much that paying attention to where that goes is almost like your best move. Trying to figure out what the institutional herd mentality, where's that capital flow going to go, and getting out in front of it.
So I have close to 1,000 employees now. You had 1,000 employees. You had a very operationally intensive business. There's something super sexy to me. Maybe it's like the grass is always greener about triple net lease industrial deals. We bought our first industrial deal earlier in the year. It's been a lot of fun. Like, it's the easiest thing ever. What you said is true. Like, real estate is real estate. Have you looked at, I mean, a lot of institutional equity is going into data centers and that side of industrial. Have you spent any time thinking about something just completely opposite of multi-office? Is kind of similar.
Totally. I mean, I have spent a lot of time looking at data centers and industrial. I mean, I want to say I like data centers better. I mean, I just think the more I learn about AI and things like that, it's just, I read yesterday, Elon Musk just built the biggest whatever in Memphis, Tennessee. I mean, the guy's such a stud. But, you know, I think that shit's here to stay. And so you got to be out. And then you read like what I was just saying about what's institutional capital going to go? What direction are they going to go? And, you know, probably a month ago, I read Blackstone is like committed to like $70 billion worth of deals already. And so it's hard to, if you get in front of that, it's hard to mess it up. You know, it's just so much capital flowing in that direction. But yeah, man, if you don't have to worry about 250 residents, 300 residents complaining, bitching, this, that, whatever, if you can sign a tight, you know, lease and, you know, that feels pretty good. And, you know, I'm too young to start playing shuffleboard, but some of these passive investments are not bad.
I want to talk a little bit about mental health. I know you're passionate about that. What do you want to say about that?
Yeah. I mean, there's a huge stigma behind it. And, you know, it's something that I've had to deal with I probably have dealt with it my whole adult life, but I'm just starting to kind of embrace it. And, you know, it's a real thing. And so I think you see more and more people starting to talk about it. It's definitely something I feel, you know, obliged to talk about. And it's something that, you know, can be a blessing or a curse. I mean, if you embrace it and deal with it, you know, it can, I think the good aspects of it can really drive you. And it, back to Elon Musk, I mean, God, that guy certainly has bipolar. He certainly has other things. And so I think, you know, that's what drives him to be able to work, you know, 2-3 days in a row. But it wreaks havoc on your private life, you know. And I always read about these entrepreneurs that were married 2-3 times and this, that, whatever, but they would accomplish amazing things in their business life. And they, you know, their personal life was troubled. And so, yeah, man, I've spent a lot of time now that I have time to deal with it. I've had a lot of help with it. And I think it's something important.
So do you think now, having spent time reading, practicing, doing whatever you're doing, that you can have some level of peace in your personal life and tremendous success in business as well?
Hopefully. I mean, that's the goal, right? I think a certain amount of entrepreneurs are always going to have that little something different, right? Like that thing that allows you to go out and take risks that other people wouldn't, right? Like the thing that doesn't go off in your head that tells you, hey, you shouldn't even be doing this. Like, you know, I think as I get a little older, I think I'm wired a little differently, but definitely embracing what makes that tick. I mean, and dealing with it and talking to experts. I mean, growing up, I didn't really hear much about it. I didn't really look into it. And now I'm fortunate enough to go and hire doctors from Harvard, things like that, that can really explain to me the ins and outs and how to deal with certain things. And, you know, I'm always a guy that likes to be in the forefront, likes to put myself out there. And for good or bad, like what you see is what you get, you know? And so I think what I want to do is kind of, I've shown, you know, the bad side. Now I want to show the good side, you know, like life is ups and downs. And that's, I think what I feel on my personal side is, you know, you get an opportunity, you always get an opportunity to fix things. And if you're willing to address it and deal with it and not be ashamed of it, you know, anything can be dealt with.
Yeah, I'm way more drawn, and I don't have many relationships purposely. I keep them tight, but I'm way more drawn to real people. You know, that means everything about them, as opposed to, like, I mean, you meet them, whether it's in the PE world or just out in life. Like, some people are just a robot, and you cannot make a connection with them, and you wonder how they're successful because they're just fucking weird, and they're like not normal. And you're like, well, this doesn't make any sense. You're probably a fake or a fraud. And I think a lot of people are fakes. So
totally. Well,
it's better to come out.
I hear it a lot that, you know, Pat, one thing I like about you is you're real. And yeah, I mean, especially at this point, like if I never have another institutional investor want to do business with me, it's not going to change my life. And they're a loss, right? I'll do it with my own capital now. And so, but again, like I wouldn't change anything. Like I look back and like just talking on this conversation, like the stuff that I did over that 10-year period was just balls to the wall, just, you know, full throttle, no concern really for the risk. You know, it was calculated risk, but it was just boom, boom, boom. And if I was one of those robots, never would have happened. You know, I'd be the fifth in line acquisition guy, and I'd have 2.5 kids and a white picket fence. I don't want that.
Doesn't sound good to me either. There's always something about the people that just create this facade, aren't real, aren't themselves, and it's uninteresting. So keep doing what you're doing, and I'm proud of you. I ask all the guests on the podcast the same closing question, and I know you love to travel, so this should be a good answer, but what is your favorite hotel?
It's changed. How do I say it? The Fugues in New York right now.
Fugues in New York?
Yeah. It's my favorite. That's where I stay. Like for 7 years, I had an apartment in New York. And I fell so much in love with this hotel that like I stay there now. Like I'll, you know, I love it.
What's good about it?
It really feels like, I guess, you know, it feels like an apartment building. I mean, everybody kind of knows you. I bring my dog there. The food is amazing. The rooms are amazing. And I really like the location there.
Yep.
Tribeca. I think I have the most sentimental feeling. I haven't been there in a while, but to the peninsula in New York. I mean, that's where I remember I had my buddy worked at Goldman Sachs and I had a Goldman Sachs rate. I would tell them I worked at Goldman and, you know, it was like $300 a night and that's where I would stay. And it was like, you felt like king of the universe. Like you would go meet with all these equity guys all day long and then come back to the peninsula. And it was just badass. It was like prototypical New York. And, you know, I remember that, you know, being decorated around Christmas, things like that. So I think New York City has the best. Paris, I mean, I've been to Paris a lot lately. I mean, they have great hotels, but I think those are my two favorite.
When I see you on social media, it seems like you're hanging out in the lobby, sitting out there. Are you meeting really interesting people at some of these hotels? I mean, part of the reason why I love staying in the best hotels is because you meet interesting people sometimes at the bar or, totally. You know, at breakfast or whatever.
Totally. I mean, that's what I think I like most about that hotel, actually, is I'll bring my laptop down or whatever or do some calls from the lobby. And one, they have beautiful women there, right? Like they'd walk through nonstop. But yeah, I'll run into debt guys. I'll run into equity guys. I'll run into other real estate guys. I like fashion. So, I was there during fashion week. You run into a lot of people. So yep. Yeah, it's a great, that's what makes New York City so awesome. And that's why when people were like, oh, New York's dead. No, I mean, it brings the smartest people. It brings the most aggressive people. It brings, you know, the best, you know, like if you're growing up in some small town in Iowa, like wherever you are, if you're the most talented person in your town, you eventually go to New York. And that's like the same from all over the world, too. You meet the smartest people, the coolest people, whatever, from all over the world. And that's what I love about New York. So, yeah, I definitely meet great people.
Thanks for coming on the pod, man. It was a lot of fun. And I'm excited to see what you do next.
Great, man. Thank you. Great question.
Hey, everyone. It's Jake here. Thanks again for joining me on this conversation. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Lastly, don't forget to follow me on Twitter @JayWorzak. I'll see you in the next episode.
Jake Worzak is the founder and CEO of Dove Hill Capital Management. All opinions expressed by Jake and his guests are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Dove Hill Capital Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not reflect or represent real estate, financial, or investment advice.